This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Okay, it's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names. And fortunately, we are here with one of the most prominent historians of 20th century Britain and the author of The Roar of the Lion, The Untold Story of Churchill's World War II Speeches. And that is Professor Richard Toy of the University of Exeter. Thank you for coming on the show, Professor.
My pleasure.
This is a very, very important book. It's one of two of the books I read the most, if you will. This and there's an American book called The Myth of Seneca Falls that have completely changed my view of an awful lot of things in modern history. I'm gripped, and I think that the Buzzkillers will be gripped by the idea that there was an untold story of Churchill's World War II speeches. What did you mean by that?
Indeed, this was sort of a surprise to me when I came to write the book, I have to say, because, there are different parts of the untold story, but as I originally conceived the book, this was going to be very much a story about what Churchill said, its diplomatic significance, the tracing of the drafting of the speeches. And so there's very much an untold story of that, because people tend to, understandably enough, simply go for the published speeches and quote them. Whereas in the Churchill archives, there's reams and reams of quite unexploited material, or unexploited at the time I wrote the book, where you've got multiple drafts of the same speech, and you've maybe got some handwritten annotations, and you've got some notes in the file. And these things between them allow you to put together the story of how the speeches were constructed, the things which people were telling Churchill, which he really ought to say or which he really ought not to say. And then I thought, as indeed was true, that you could then sort of see how these were received in the newspapers and what the significance of particular speeches was thought to be at the time, which is not necessarily the same significance as you get from a 21st century reading of what you think are necessarily the sort of the important bits. So that was my original plan, and I stuck to it. But what surprised me was that the audience reactions were very different from what we've conventionally been told. And so I really thought that I was going to have to say a little bit about how people reacted to the speeches, but this was essentially going to be a series of people just saying, well, that was fantastic. I really love that speech. I feel so inspired. I feel so energized. I feel so galvanized. Now, of course, this was something which a very large number of people, probably the majority of them did feel. But what was unexpected was this much larger substratum of criticism, comment, thoughtful reflection, actually, on what Churchill had said, but also people saying that they were depressed by his speeches, that they were bored by him, or that they liked the speech, but their neighbor didn't, or vice versa. And so it was very rich seam of material, which I found. And, I'd collected a lot of this, before obviously writing the book, but it was actually the process of writing it, sort of seeing the reactions to each individual speech, taking all the bits of evidence that I'd got, and then seeing the conventional story really kind of fell apart, because we're given a sort of retrospective view, which is actually a lot of it is based on an essay which Isaiah Berlin wrote in 1949, so several years after the speeches had actually been delivered, sort of talking about sort of the wonderful effects that the speeches had had, and this being treated by many historians as though it was the same as contemporary evidence which was given on the day, and yet clearly many people's reactions were very different, and that they themselves often sometimes thought Churchill was wonderful, but 2 months later would be saying that he was a terrible waste of space. So it was simply this huge amount of evidence, which was going quite contrary to essentially what was a very sustained and indeed continuing, even in spite of the book, I have to say, a myth to this day.
Yes, it is. It's myth and it's very strong. And I like to go back for a minute and because one of the things I think that's the strongest, certainly in my perception and in the way I see it, especially in the modern day media, is the idea that Churchill was the sole constructor of these speeches, that they were almost spontaneous, that he's a literary genius and cranked them out. And just like the fact that FDR's Fireside Chats went through multiple drafts and an enormous amount of commentary from cabinet members and other people, the Churchill speeches are exactly the same thing. So it's not speech by committee, but there's an awful lot of input from other people.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, this was something which took up a huge amount of his time. Really, yeah. If you consider all the responsibilities that he had. I mean, it would take him sort of 3 or 4 days to construct one of these things. And as I said, you can sort of see the multiple drafts in the archives. And what would happen was that generally drafts would be circulated to different government departments with requests for comments, or sections of the speech which applied to sort of particularly the responsibility of the military departments. They would get back section right. of the speech. And so there came a point where, particularly getting close to delivery, where Churchill would sort of cease to be receptive to additional points. He'd sort of say, well, what bloody fool said that kind of thing. Yeah. But in general, although he might react sort of strongly in terms of saying, well, this comment is ridiculous, if it was actually a well-founded comment, then he was intelligent enough and subtle enough to actually take those points on board. So I think that there is a myth, which of course he did a lot to cultivate himself, that he was somebody yeah. who simply did what he wanted, who sort of charged through irrespective of anything that anybody else might say. He was actually more collegial in some respects than we're normally led to believe.
Yeah, and I think also another thing that people forget is how, unless you really are a Churchill expert, that this... You often hear experts and people in his inner circle say he has this enormous capacity for hard work and spends an awful lot of time, and in fact had spent a lifetime writing before he became prime minister.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, many people before me had pointed out that some of the famous phrases in the speeches had, if they hadn't been used before in that exact form, they had been used in sort of different combinations. So sort of good example is that in his visit to Africa in 1987, he visited a dam and written about it that never has so much water been held up by so little masonry or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, he's somebody who really having a conversation with Churchill is often very much like being treated to a draft speech. And so he's obviously he is egotistical, he is solipsistic, but at the same time he's watching other people's reactions. He's not right. He's not oblivious to what other people think. And one can see that he's perpetually refining or honing his words, thinking, well, something like this could well come in useful one day, even if not tomorrow or if not next week.
It seems to me a very sophisticated way of not only realizing that you've got to be a rhetorical politician, but of actually planning your, or at least working with your material to make a rhetorical political life.
Yes. I mean, I think he benefited from the fact that the news cycle was not so intense as it is today.
Yeah, right.
So, these were sort of draining events for him when he had to make these speeches, particularly in the first half of the war, when he was not only Prime Minister, but leader of the House of Commons, which created additional responsibilities for him. And he was giving a kind of a monthly report on the war to the House of Commons, quite aside from any other speeches that he might be giving. But at the same time, he kind of has the space to do this preparation amidst all the other things that are going on. He isn't being expected to respond to in real time to journalists. He sort of locks himself away for 3 days, comes up with a brilliant speech, and then certainly there's fallout. It's not the case that he doesn't have any media criticism to deal with. Quite the contrary, but he's not being forced to respond to sort of every criticism that's leveled at him through a 24-hour news cycle.
Right. Well, that's very interesting because another thing I think that certainly most people don't know, and even a lot of interested history people don't know, that is that public opinion was measured in a way in the 1940s and even slightly earlier through things like mass observation and other polling devices. Can you tell Buzzkillers a little bit about that and how, and can we start a conversation about how Churchill's speeches are seen through those various devices?
Yeah, so Mass Observation was a fascinating organization which was founded in 1937. And it was a sociological research organization which wanted to investigate what it called the science of ourselves. So it was looking very much at ordinary people and conceiving as public opinion as, if you like, the collectivity of the your private opinions of millions of individuals, which isn't, for example, the way in which public opinion would have been viewed in the sort of pre-1914 period.
Right.
And so Mass Observation have got a variety of techniques. They're asking people to write, ordinary people to write diaries and send them in. They are also giving what are called directives. So they say, they say to their network of sort of volunteers, could you tell us what you think about the coronation, for example, or you know, another event like that. And then their volunteers are also sort of out in streets or sitting on buses or in pubs, observing, listening to what other people have said and writing it all down. And they do, you know, wonderful, crazy stuff like, now we're going to count the numbers of people at football matches who are wearing hats. So there are these photographs in the Mass Observation Archive of, you know, of these football matches so that people count the hats. So you've got this very, very rich source of information at the same time as you've got organizations like the Gallup organization who are doing what we would now think of as conventional opinion polls. And during the war itself, from 1940 through the end of 1944, you have the Ministry of Information and its Home Intelligence Division who are producing what are called Home Intelligence Reports. So daily from May 1940 through to the autumn of 1940, they are monitoring opinion. And then it's weekly after that when they're a bit less concerned about morale. And they're very, very keen to know what the reactions of ordinary people are to ministers' speeches, and of course, in particular, to Churchill's speeches. And when you add in, you can add in sort of other people's diaries from, you know, non-mass observation sources as well. So you have this very rich body of material. It has, you know, people, of course, criticizing the book would say, oh, well, you know, in effect, this material is all sort of worthless. It's not really scientific. Or, of course, a legitimate point, but I did acknowledge this in the book, is that mass observation volunteers tended to be, you know, middle-class people of progressive views.
Right.
Now, yeah, that's true. I mean, I pointed out in the book, but also there were clearly many of the observers, mass observers, who weren't of those views. And equally, people report not only their own views, but they report the views of those around them, even when those views are contrary to their own views. So they may say, well, I was surprised that other people didn't like Mr. Churchill's speech because I thought it was marvelous, you know, or vice versa. So clearly one needs to read this material cautiously. But equally, I think that when you consider the Ministry of Information material as well, and the other diaries that we have, these things map onto each other. So it may be that Mass Observation, in its own reports, it doesn't just collect material; it sort of writes up what it has found into reports. It may be that it sort of sometimes over eggs the omelet in terms of the amount of criticism there is, because this is sees itself as a sort of progressive organization.
Right.
But at the same time, in the Ministry of Information reports, you can also see that they're playing down certain kinds of criticism because this is stuff which is going to go to ministers. So, you know, plenty of diarists on a couple of occasions, shouldn't exaggerate how often it is, but, you know, on a couple of occasions will say, you know, Churchill was drunk when he delivered this speech over the radio. In the Ministry of Information reports, this becomes, there were criticisms of Mr. Churchill's delivery.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it's very different. It's much softer. Well, we'd like to talk about the what I think is one of the most crucial things in the book, and one of the things that where I learned the most was what happens in the later years of the war, 43 to 45. But we'll do that after the sponsorship break. But in the early years of the war, particularly when he comes up, when he becomes prime minister, and then there's the Battle of Britain, can you give us a sense of the range of different types of reaction to his speeches? I mean, were there, you know, I know there's probably no way to quantify this, you know, that they were 55% popular and 45% unpopular. But I was surprised at how much comment there was, A, and B, how wide-ranging it was.
Yes. I mean, there are occasional points where you can quantify it, although whether or not you believe the methodology of the people who were doing the quantification at the right. time is a different question. So, you know, on one occasion, the BBC listener surveys are another source of information, although they don't generally report reactions. But on one occasion, they say, you know, 63% of the listenership approved of Mr. Churchill's speech, which was rather low. Unfortunately, they don't say what they consider a normal or a high figure to be.
Right.
But then, you know, that shows, you know, I don't want to exaggerate what I'm saying here. What I'm saying is that there's a much larger body of criticism than we're led to believe, because led to believe that it was, you know, essentially unanimous, apart from kind of one or two eccentric people.
Pulled the whole country through.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that even if you up the level of criticism and say, well, let's say it was 20%, then that's an awful lot higher than we've generally been told. It may well have been higher than that. But to go back to 1940, well, I think that one has to first to say, I'm not criticizing the speeches. This was was understood to be, I was to be saying when the book was published and it, you know, got reviews. But in order to understand the actual reaction, you have to understand what Churchill was trying to do. And that what he was trying to do very often was to bring people bad news in a way in which they were going to be able to cope with it, and it wasn't going to destroy their morale. But in the context of bringing them that bad news, often, very naturally, people became depressed. And so, you know, or at the very, you know, sometimes, as I've said, they'd be invigorated, but other people would say, well, we sort of received this with sort of solemnity, if you like. So that may be a kind of a positive reaction. It may have been the reaction which Churchill was looking for,
right.
but it's not the reaction that we're always told occurred. And so, of course, as Churchill brings people this information, and this I think is the key to this, one of the keys to the speeches, is that they are full of information, and they're not just full of inspirational phrases,
right.
but the
That's
phrases
right. yeah.
which we know, which we hear repeated over and over again on documentaries, is a tiny proportion of the, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words which he was producing. So what he was doing, he was giving people information, but also giving them the context in which they should understand that information. And so how do people react? For example, his famous speech of June 1940, the, you know, the fight them on the beaches speech. Well, one of the things he says in that speech is, we will fight on for years if necessary, you know, if necessary alone. And
right.
again, from 21st century perspective, you just go, yeah, this is Churchill, you know, doing his ordinary stuff alone. We know all about that. But of course, the reaction at the time is, what does he mean, alone?
Yeah.
Because the French are still in the war.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, people are saying, is he trying to drop a hint that the French are going to drop out of the war? Well, yes, he is.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
This is very unpleasant information to receive. And so, of course, people are downcast by this, or they're worried, or they're confused. And so, you know, really, I would say that people's reactions to the speeches go in line to a considerable extent with military events. And so that when the war is going well, then, of course, you know, ministers' speeches which depict how well the war is going are going to be popular. When the war's going badly, not even a terrific speech can overcome, you know, the sense that disasters are unfolding. So I would say that although, you know, sort of in popular memory, kind of the key speeches, the most inspiring of Churchill's speeches are the fight them on the beaches and their finest hour, that one from June the 18th. And, right. and again, the speech from 20th of August, of which is the few speech. That, yeah, those are the ones which we would highlight. And yet I would say in terms of, you know, evidence of greatest popularity, then we actually ought to be looking to a couple of speeches in July, where the first of those is Churchill's speech on the destruction of the French fleet, which he gives at the beginning of July in the House of Commons. So it's actually not broadcast. So this is why none of us have ever actually heard it. We've only, if we know of it, we've read it.
Right, right.
It doesn't contain any famous phrases. It's a very careful, detailed outlining of the course of action which has led the British to attack the people who were their allies, you know, just a couple of weeks before.
Yeah.
And you know, it then becomes difficult to separate the reaction to the speech from the reaction to the events. So people are, of course, actually greatly cheered by this because finally it appears that the British have done something.
Right.
And they're, you know, okay, it's against the French rather than the Germans, but, you know, what the hell? And so they're greatly cheered by that. And then in mid-July, there's a speech, which again, nobody remembers, called the speech of the sort of the War of the Unknown Warriors, where Churchill conjures up the idea that this is a people's war. And again, you can never, there's, you know, rarely, if ever, an occasion where there's no criticism, but the volume of criticism at that point really does seem to be very tiny. And
yeah.
So when you take, for example, the sort of the blood and toil, tears and sweat speech, which he makes in the Commons of 13th of May, 1940, obviously it's a wonderful speech. But in terms of the popular reaction, or indeed anybody's reaction, including diarists, they don't make a big fuss about it. The MP diarists who were there in the chamber at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just you'd sort of think everybody would recognize this was wonderful, but it's just a kind of a resounding silence, except for one comment in the Ministry of Information report that says, well, obviously we don't need much more of this.
Right, because it's too dark.
Yeah,
too
okay.
Dark. Yeah, negative, yeah. Well, this is a good time for us to take a little break, because after the sponsored break, I'd like to hear about, I think our listeners would love to hear about how the reaction to his rhetoric and his war leadership changes in the later years of the war. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. As you might well guess, Buzzkillers, this episode is being sponsored by the Great Courses Plus. If you want to understand these Churchill myths we're talking about, of course you need to understand the general biography of Churchill and the biography of what he did and the history of how these things developed in the 20th century. The Great Courses Plus has the perfect course for you to watch and listen to about this subject. It's called How Winston Churchill Changed the World by Professor Michael Sheldon. It goes through not only Churchill's whole career, but all the contextual background and all of the major events. Remember, Churchill lives for almost forever. He lives from 1874 until 1965. It's a very, very important analysis of what happens during that time and his place in each of those events. Now, that's one of the reasons I love the Great Courses Plus. They have excellent professors who teach you exactly what you need to know. And you, of course, can have a free trial because you're a Buzzkiller. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill to start your free trial. There's so much to learn and discover. Classics like history, literature, and science, and even hobbies and activities like chess, which I'm terrible at, and all sorts of things you wouldn't ordinarily expect in a courses program like this. They're all there. Their streaming service offers engaging lectures about anything and everything, and you can watch it on all of your devices, your television, your computer, your iPad, your phone, whatever, whatever, whatever. And it's the perfect time to sign up for the Great Courses Plus. That's because, as I said, my listeners get free access to their entire library. That's right, free. Don't wait any longer. Sign up today using my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. And now, back to more Churchill. Okay, Buzzkillers, we're back with Professor Richard Toy from the University of Exeter talking about his wonderful book, Roar of the Lion, The Untold Story of Churchill's World War II Speeches. Professor, when we left you before the break, you were talking about, you know, the Churchill speeches and not only how they were constructed and how complicated that is and how interesting and sophisticated the work on it was, but how the range of opinion of his about his early speeches was so broad in 1940-41. Do things change after the war's been going on for a while? I mean, obviously Buzzkillers will know that Churchill loses the election of 1945, but one of the things that impressed me in the book is I learned for the first time how early on, relatively, you start to hear grumblings, even in the military.
Yes, I suspect that a sort of a great untapped, you know, sort of well of discontent, if you mm-hmm. like. Mm-hmm. We have some soldiers, of course, kept diaries, but in terms of the mass observation and the home intelligence reports that I've been talking about, you know, they weren't, on the whole, capturing the views of service people. Right. And so I think that there was probably an anti-authority feeling. If you're okay. in the military, you know, the people who are in charge probably strike you as idiots. There's an awful lot of sitting around, and then you're told to do something, and then you're told to undo it again, and it's all very, very frustrating. And so I think that Churchill was, you know, it wouldn't have mattered who was prime minister, that Churchill was probably, to a certain extent, the victim of that, that, you know, he's just the guy in charge.
Yeah.
Picking up on this is a little bit difficult because although it would be fascinating to know the, you know, when soldiers' letters were censored and so on,
right.
What information was coming out from there, we've got very little evidence seems to have survived, except for on one occasion in late 1944 when there was controversy over British actions in Greece. And the censorship reports, which officers were writing, were actually, you know, pretty pro-Churchill over that episode. And so Churchill was kind of keen to have this circulated to, you know, written up as a report and circulated to the cabinet. So I think there's, you know, there remains an area where we might have suspicions about whether or not the, you know, the range of opinion fell in one way or the other. But that's a kind of an area which still remains rather opaque. Uh-huh. In terms of the sort of the public, ordinary sort of citizens' views as the war goes on, well, of course, you know, it becomes there's a very dark situation early in 1942, which persists through really most of the first half of 42. So you've got the fall of Singapore in February, you've got the fall of Tobruk mm-hmm. in the summer, and then you've got got the turn of the tide with the Battle of El Alamein in the autumn of 1942. Throughout all this, even then, when it becomes clear that, you know, Britain is clearly going to win, Britain's allies are clearly going to win, then there's still actually considerable criticism of Churchill. I think the conventional story is that everybody recognised his great martial qualities, but at the same time didn't think that he was the person to lead Britain into the peace. And therefore mm-hmm. this sort of, you know, bifurcation, if you like, allows us to explain why he was supposedly so very, very popular during the war and yet lost the general election in 1945. Actually, there's considerable criticism on the military front and the foreign policy front particularly as well. So his liking or alleged liking for kings is something which is which crops up again and again, that, you know, sort of there's an aristocratic figure who is you know, beholden to royalty and therefore favors sort of non-democratic solutions to post-war Europe is something which crops up. And he is also perceived as being, I think unfairly, actually, I have to say, as dictatorial, that this comes up through some of his interventions in domestic politics during by-elections, for example, or when he objects to the fact that the House of Commons, he does get defeated in the House of Commons over the question of equal pay for women teachers, and he kind of sort of stamps his foot and insists that the vote is reversed. Then he is sort of picked up in various sources as being a dictator. And so there's actually more to the criticism than just that we don't think that he's got a vision for the post-war domestic world.
Oh, that's fascinating, because I think that's what the general perception is, that right until after VE Day, everyone is pro-Churchill, and then they realize that that they want a Labour government afterwards, but that's more complicated than that.
People had long memories, you know.
Yeah.
And they, however much they were prepared for the meantime to put some of their differences with him aside, they did remember his support for the white forces during the Russian Civil War. Mm-hmm. They remembered his actions during the general strike. You know, he's also interesting what is perhaps less controversial, things which he'd be criticized for today, which he was less criticized for. For example, his opposition to greater self-government for India. There were a few diarists who say, oh, well, you know, this is sort of typical Churchill imperialist and so on.
Right. Well,
that's not actually a major line of criticism, when perhaps maybe it should have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, Buzzkillers, we want you to go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and get this book, because as I've said several times, this is really something that opened up my eyes about all sorts of things, Churchill, and all sorts of things about how things were gauged and measured and how opinion worked in the opinion was conveyed in the 30s and 40s. And it just remains for me to say thank you very much, Professor, for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And I hope we can talk to you again about future Churchill books. And so we'll say to the Buzzkillers that we will talk to you next week.